Welcome to episode 6 of the Frontal Harvest Podcast.
A podcast about science, technology, and education, and Dicer.
Dicer. I'm Patrick.
And I'm Kelly. And together we're the hosts of Frontal Harvest Podcast.
So let's get started. So this is the 26th of March. And we're recording it to put out on the 29th, which will be Sunday. And, well, I don't know. This might be a pretty short one. or it might not. We'll have to see. But we had an incredibly busy week. And for those of you that have been following the podcast, you know that we just have spent months now getting ready for our orienteering meet, which was this last Sunday.
And it was good.
Yeah, it went really well. I was surprised.
Actually. I was too. We had 23 participants.
Yeah.
And
so are we going to, is that part of, let me see, that's not what you wrote your blog about.
So.
Oh, is it? Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we should cut off now and then go over it when you do your blog, because it'll be a good segue into the topics of interest.
Okay, sounds great.
I think we're going to do our blogs in reverse order, because really, it's always going to be my blog that was written first and then your blog second when we do the podcast.
Right.
So maybe I'll start with mine.
Okay, sounds fair.
I think that's why we got off track and started discussing the wrong ones. Because they're backwards from what we had done. Anyway, so I wrote about the way we use a trail GPS. And I mean, this has really become a use of GPS that we don't use it every time we go out, but every time we do, it's pretty much the same way. And we don't, it's really been a fantastic technology. But we don't really use it when we're out there. We use it in the sense that we have it record our track. And some hikes, we just leave it in a backpack and we don't worry about it until we get home. Other hikes, we actually take waypoints. But we don't look at the maps or anything. And I actually don't remember where I first read about using the GPS that way. But since we've started to use it like this, it's been just an incredible thing to get home and to bring up a map and to see everywhere you've hiked and have the waypoints. So that's what I wrote my blog about. Okay. Oh, and then about georeferencing. I should say a little bit more there, because what has made it possible is a program called QLandCart. Landcart spelt with a K, and this is a truly any program that would allow you to put your GPS on a map and see where you've been is going to be a fantastic program, in my way of thinking about it. But that's the one that we're using, and it's been a fantastic thing to have. We what's called georeference a map. Meaning basically you turn the image of your map into a TIFF that has information in the file about the latitude and longitude of points on the map. And you can do that using QLandCart. And this allows the program to superimpose your track and waypoints on the map. And so we get home and we put our track on the map and take some screenshots of that, and then bring it up in some kind of graphics program like GIMP and add some text and pictures about different places we've been, and just it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, and during the orienteering, it was really handy to figure out if we had the reentrant right.
Yeah, we used it a lot for planning this last meet.
As well as the distant viewfinder.
Both as well as a laser rangefinder.
Or laser rangefinder. Both tools were just
Yeah. Although I thought it was interesting. We use the laser range finder out on the trail a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And we got into this really good system where you'd figure out the direction and you'd do mm-hmm. the compass course. And I would just do the laser range finder. And with two of us like that, we had both. I mean, this allowed you to really concentrate on the direction.
Right, right.
So you could be very precise. And our distance, of course, was quite precise because of the mm-hmm. laser range finder. So I think that's helped a lot. And, you know, I mean, I don't want to go off topic about the OMI, but it's worth mentioning now. We had a lot of people say that usually when people start off, they'll put a couple controls a fair bit off from mm-hmm. when they mark them on the map. And everybody who checked ours said that they couldn't find a single control that was more than just a little bit off.
Mm-hmm.
So that was gratifying.
That was really exciting for me because I was concerned about, you know, how our controls were placed. Because we tried our best.
Yeah.
But
and spent a lot of time out
and
there.
And spent a lot of time out there. And there are so many things that were on the land that were not on the map, so it made it very difficult.
So maybe we'll go on to your blog entry, because you said you mentioned this at least a little
yeah.
bit, and that's pretty much all I had in mind.
Okay. So my blog entry, I was sitting there at the orienteering meet, and as people were coming in, and orienteering is very relaxed. People, when they arrive, they will go out on the course. You may be on a different course than other people that are going out at the same time, or you may be on the same course. And when you finish, it's very much your own time when you finish and how you did between each control. So, although, you know, everyone wants to do their best, it's not the competitive event that you have with a mass start. And because of that, when people finish, it's a very social time, and they look at their map and they tell you places where, oh my goodness, this place, I don't know what I was thinking, I got off here, and oh, in this particular case, I could have really used more map over here.
That was the one complaint we had.
Yeah, it was. And it was a good one. And it was just funny because it was a harebrained error where I got focused on getting the controls on the map or the control descriptions. And I totally forgot about the outlying of the map and where it was placed.
So for people listening,
mm-hmm.
To explain what happened is the area we were in has a lake on the west side,
mm-hmm.
and some of our controls were placed pretty close to the lake.
Right.
And I think originally when we made the map, it showed the lake on the
mm-hmm.
west and,
it did.
And the road on the
mm-hmm.
right. And somehow in
arranging
the map,
at the printer place.
Yeah, we moved the area that would be printed eastward.
Right.
So, and one of the guys, it was so funny, it was Robert, he came in and he and he got to that control that was the closest to the lake on the southwest end. And he said he could see the lake. He was, and he looked at the map. He's like, how can this be? How can this be? There's a lake there and there's no lake. Of course, it was just being tired from being out running in the woods because, of course, he was looking at an area that was beyond the paper, right? And yet, there's no lake on the map.
I was like, oh, I can't believe I did that. But anyway, I did, and it happened.
Yeah.
But see, we're getting this wonderful feedback, like from Robert and other people coming back over the course. And it was just really good to hear, oh, this was really challenging to me. These two controls, this one was easy to get to. I had no problem with that. And, you know, as they're pointing it out in the map, of course, we know where the controls are because we walked to them like 10 times in the last two weekends, and we could practically do the course without a compass by the end.
When we were sending out controls, that was the Saturday before, the day before, I think a lot of the controls, we didn't bother taking a compass.
Yeah, I mean, I was using readings. A compass, but I was really comfortable with knowing that, oh my goodness, we're coming up to it. It's right down there. Yeah. And you felt the same.
And but we were going back and forth who was in the lead.
Yeah.
And I didn't use the range finder except for a couple times to double check some. Although, while sending controls, we caught one that was in the wrong place.
We did. We did. And we changed it up. So we were... You know, we were using it on and off, and we were checking areas that we hadn't visited as often, like seven.
Well, the one we changed, we hadn't been to since very early on.
Right, right.
Before we had purchased the laser rangefinder.
Right, and we were so confident that we had it in the right place, and then the day before the event, we changed it.
Well, I'm not sure. I guess I was kind of confident, but...
Yeah.
But we hadn't visited it.
We hadn't.
In so long. So.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things. But anyway, back to the great, you know, information we're getting back from these people. And it was making us reflect a lot because it was staggered finish that Patrick and I would talk after they left and would say, oh, did you notice they said this and this about the course? Or did you hear them mention... And then we would talk about it. Well, what I was realizing as I was setting up my blog for this week, I was like, wow, you know, this is exactly what's needed by anyone working on a project, that you get that feedback and that you're able to reflect on it and to just think about what's being said about certain aspects. And in this case, the aspects of our course that we had chosen over, you know, the last month or so as we were fine-tuning our course that we were going to set for the participants. And, you know, and I started to think, and this is exactly some of the stuff that the kids really need, is just that reflection part. Of when they're building something and they go through the building process, they build it, but then they stop after it's running or working in the way that they had intended. And then just...
So this is part of your blog and...
Yeah.
I mean, I saw the title, Experience is Key. So it's going into that.
Yeah. And so it's having that experience, but time to reflect on that experience that I think really... helps it be a valuable experience in which you can use that as a springboard to improve. Where if we had planned it individually, we were getting, you know, responses back from the participants, but we didn't have the time to kind of think through it and talk back and forth about different parts of what they were saying or what we're hearing. It wouldn't have helped us, I think, improve a course for next time.
Right.
Like, we both have these ideas now, like map parameters. Daha, yes, we're totally going to focus on that before the stupid, you know, control and the way we're placing the control descriptions on the map, which is a no-brainer. But the first time through, it's like, just get the map printed. Make sure the scale's correct. And, and you know,
well, so we concentrated on many things trying to get everything correct.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the one thing that slipped through.
Oh, yeah. But that's okay. You know, but it won't next
It's not
time.
A thing we forgot about.
No.
Because originally, before we tried to put the control descriptions, we had been careful to put the map in a way that would show all controls with area around them.
Yeah.
It's afterwards we moved it when putting the control descriptions on.
Right, right. But anyway, so it was just, I know that the students that had to make a video about their car running and how they would improve it next time, having to prepare that little 2-minute video really helped them reflect with their partners about how to attack that kind of project again.
So this is the STEM competition.
The STEM competition. And
so last blog. It hadn't even sent in yet.
No, it hadn't been. So last week, among all the craziness and having no internet, we had to send in electronically the video for the STEM competition.
I got to see part of that.
Yeah.
That was cool.
And they did a really wonderful job, I think. They got a car running and it ran further than they ever expected. And because of the sporadic sun cloud combination that we had, it was the best run they had.
I love the video following the car.
Yeah.
And everybody's like, oh, and then you hear scream, move it, move this off. And then you see it arrive by some
books,
backpacks and some stuff. Books. And you see little hands rip the stuff out of the way. And then suddenly it crashes into a backpack. And they're like, oh, no.
So it was fun and a very worthy competition to be part of. Whether, you know, we go on or not, it doesn't matter. But the whole process and the video part, I think, really gave the students the reflection they needed, similar to the reflection that we got after and during the orienteering.
Is that it?
That's it.
Well, that's good. So maybe we should go right into from the stem cell competition. Is that what it's called?
Because STEM solar?
Solar competition. Mm-hmm. Solar. I'm remembering the fuel cell competition from earlier. Into your other school activity, this last Saturday.
Oh, yeah. So this last Saturday, we were able to get a Raspberry Pi up and running, thanks to Patrick coming in and working with students.
Thanks to me, we were only able to set up one instead of three. But, oh, what a screw up.
But I wrote about that. And you know, so we had many problems. One, that at school, there's some kind of administration block on my computer. So I wasn't able to download the Raspberry Pi Raspbian onto the SD card. There's some kind of block that's put on my computer.
But didn't you give it to me? Or did I download it separately?
You downloaded it.
No,
I downloaded it, I couldn't open it. There's some kind of administration block on me that I couldn't unzip it. That's what it was. I couldn't unzip it on my computer.
Yeah, but that was neither here nor there. I mean, you just put it on a USB stick and then I took it over.
Right, right. And then I just put on a USB stick and handed it over to Patrick.
Yeah. But that's the way it should have been because you were busy with the kids and stuff.
Yeah. I had 17 other students that were also working on different things, makies and little bits and some that were making 3D models on an iPad. So the kids were all kind of doing different things. And then Pat had three students working on the Raspberry Pi.
Yep.
And as he was setting up his SD card, ready to get the other two SD cards set for the Raspberry Pis, his computer battery died.
Well, yeah. So let's put this in order. Okay. First, I DD copied Raspbian onto the SD card.
Mm-hmm.
But I did something really silly. You have to copy it right onto the partition from the very beginning. And so I looked up what the partition was and, or the location of the SD card was. And it was dev SDC, I think, or maybe it was SDB. Let's say SDB. And instead of sending it to SDB, I sent it to SDB1, which is instead of the beginning of the SD card memory, it's the beginning of the SD card's memory's first partition.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't realize I did that. I mean, I don't know. This is just so stupid because I've done this so many times and I should have known. And I don't, I think it's, I'm not used to having kids running crazy around me, screaming at me about how the Raspberry Pi works because they're so excited. Holy smokes. But anyway, so then we put it into a Raspberry Pi and it doesn't work, right? And so I'm like, okay, great. So this is not working. I don't know why. And then as soon as I realized what happened, I'm like, oh no, it's in the first partition. And so I bring it back to my computer, and on that one, I had already started writing the second one.
Mm-hmm.
And then we had three of them, and I didn't realize noobs, I don't think it's an operating system. I think it's an installer. I could be wrong about this.
Yeah, but, sure.
You know, I ruined two of the cards temporarily by writing all over them, but one of them was left over, and that's the one we got the Raspberry Pi working on, and that was noobs. And when we put the noobs operating system SD card in, it then allowed us to choose between the different operating systems.
Mm-hmm.
And one of them was Raspbian. Mm-hmm. So that's what I did. And I think one of the kids was telling me that once you do that, it deletes all the other ones from the card to give you space.
Right.
I'm not sure. That's what he said anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And then in trying to write one of the SD cards, I had messed up and the computer battery died, which is crazy because when I was at the meeting using my laptop without being able to plug it in, I don't know if you remember, I'd written a script that keeps writing what's the battery state to a text file.
So right.
Okay. Well, I was bringing it, I don't know, pretty low, like down to 20% or so.
Mm-hmm.
This time, it got down to, I think, 60% and then just died. And it didn't just die. It's like, I must have had it on a setting so
right.
that it doesn't do anything when the battery power goes too low. Mm-hmm. So the screen was going funky and other stuff wasn't working, but it wasn't going into hibernate.
Right, right.
So maybe I need to... Maybe that's a bad thing to have happen. I mean, I suppose you could really mess up your drive by
right.
having it try to operate with the power supply not keeping up. Anyway, so, oh, you know, we moved on, but, you know, we should say, I think this is a fun opportunity since we have the blog. I mean, not the blog, the podcast, is to go back and mention a couple things about the Omeet,
okay.
which I totally forgot, but this is really important about how the brain works. One thing that I thought was just going to be silly is how we were going to have people go right up a river for one of our very long legs.
Yeah, and we were so disappointed by that.
And yeah, and so I really wanted to get this in because this was a revelation. It was the one aspect of our course that we didn't have time to change, which mm-hmm. we were really
like, disappointed by.
This is not a good part of the course.
Right.
Because you don't want to give people running distance where they don't need to think.
Right.
I mean, that's
and that's was our
that's
fear.
Not bad. Yeah. And yet we kind of knew, you know, going downriver is easy because
right.
everything collects you to the same spot.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, going upriver isn't so easy.
Mm-hmm.
But looking at the map and having been there so many times, we just got used to that river, and I guess we really knew it.
Right.
But it turns out a lot of people found it really challenging thinking about it as, you know, going through, going upriver, because there were many places where you could make mistakes.
Right, right.
So,
and I was surprised by that, and David showed me.
Big Waller?
Yeah. He was showing me different areas that people could get confused and that he was challenged by it.
Yeah. So actually, you know what we should do? We should mention this was done at Falls Lake.
Right.
East of Durham in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And the park authorities, I guess you'd say, rangers, they were friendly to work with
yes,
by email and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that's neat is this is far for most people to do orienteering.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, we had several people that stayed and helped pickups, and I thought, you know, that's really nice.
I thought so too.
Vladimir and Tatiana Stemkovsky, mm-hmm. And Robert Enox.
Right.
And we had tons of help from also Ian Shields, who helped us with the mapping and the software and how to do the control boxes and mm-hmm. all the electronics, how to handle those.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I thought that was
that's
worth mentioning.
No, definitely. It was, you know, when people have to drive another hour and you're getting later in the afternoon, it's
nice to have people that will pick up stuff.
It is, because we could have been there to 6 or 7 at night picking up all those controls by ourselves. So that was good.
Yep. Anyway, didn't mean to tear us apart from the Raspberry Pi stuff, but we talked about that river so much.
Oh, we did.
And it was such a surprise that people still got confused by it.
Yeah.
And yet the theory is you should get confused, right?
Yeah.
Your brain, as you go upstream or up reentrance, you get different choices.
Mm-hmm.
And it can be a challenge
mm-hmm.
Reading the map. So, anyway. So back to the Raspberry Pi. So we got the one working.
We did.
And mm-hmm. the kids were all excited.
One in particular,
yep.
Nonstop talker,
yep.
And very excited.
Yeah.
Yep. And two older students who were very quiet because they wanted to get the Pi going.
Yeah.
And use it. But neat thing, because I thought after that experience, the two quieter students may just drop the Pi and be like, done. I don't want to go back to it. But instead, both of them came in and worked on the pies two separate times at lunch. And one of them came in three times to work on the pie.
That's really cool.
And also, one of them in particular is just looking at it, looking at another computer to look at possible projects, uh-huh. and really trying to think of something they would like to take on. So very excited about what they do with it in the future.
Oh, that's cool.
Mm-hmm. So that's everything from
for the blogs.
Blogs.
And then and beyond. We kind of went mm-hmm. beyond our blogs.
But we did.
But there were so many good connections with this mm-hmm. last meet that we directed.
Yeah.
So.
Okay. Would you like to start with some special topics?
Okay. So you want mine first this time?
Sure.
Okay. We're doing everything backwards, but I think that's probably the right way to do it.
Okay. I think it's because it's you're going first.
So the first one, it's really short, and I wish I'd had time to look up stuff on this, but we saw a beautiful hawk outside the house, and you're thinking it's part of the mating pair that we've had in the neighborhood.
Right.
And I think when we looked it up, I think it's a red-shouldered hawk.
Mm-hmm.
At the time, I don't think I'd ever known of a red-shouldered or seen a red-shouldered hawk and knew it. But it had a beautiful black and white banded tail
mm-hmm.
and barred rufous mm-hmm. on the breast. And when I looked up on the Cornell Lab of Ornithology and in our book, it seemed the only one that had the right range
mm-hmm.
and the right markings.
Yeah.
So
beautiful bird.
Absolutely. And it was right there across the street. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
Yeah. Good identification. I think they're part of the reason why our squirrel population goes from having sometimes up to 7 squirrels out by our feeder to
suddenly... No. I mean, sometimes we go with that.
Yeah.
That was it was a pretty big hawk.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it could probably take a squirrel.
There were two of them, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So not as big as a red tail, but, or it didn't seem so anyway.
Right.
But still
right.
quite large.
Yeah.
So and we have tons of red tails around here.
We do. So. We do. But very nice, and nice to have as part of our feeding community.
Was it Dr. Kroll that used to be, that used to say about having a multitrophic level fear?
Yeah, he used to get really excited. Yeah.
Anyway, so that was one thing I wanted to just mention. It's a new one for our little list at the bird feeder, although mm-hmm. it wasn't really at the bird feeder, but close by. The other one is we just had eye appointments.
Yes.
And it's the first time I've had an eye appointment in a very long time. Well, since the 1990s. And so there were two things that were really neat. One, so glaucoma is having the higher pressure in the eye. Is that right?
Right. It's when they do the pressure yeah. test.
So I didn't totally understand, but when I asked, it seemed like they put this instrument up against your head. And there's a little shaft with a little ball. I mean, this mm-hmm. is really thin. And it actually hits your eyeball mm-hmm. and bounces off. And at first I'm like, it just goes real close and the air or something is, mm-hmm. right? But I think, no, it bounces off. Anyway, the lady couldn't quite get it in mind. And she's like, hitting me in the eyeball with it. And I'm like, whoa. Let's try this one. Okay, let's try this one. Oh, let's try this one again. Quack, quack, quack. It's like a little fist coming at you. Anyway, it's funny. But I wonder how, like, the mechanism, how it senses and like, the construction inside and
yeah,
how it's calibrated. And
I didn't think it was supposed to touch your eyeball.
I think it does.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I think it bounces off. You. Yeah. It might be, I don't know, it might be air blowing out that pushes the shaft with a little ball.
Right.
And then it bounces back, and how far back in it goes.
Right.
Measures the, that would be elasticity.
Mm-hmm.
Which increased pressure would make it stiffer. Anyway, so that was kind of neat. And the other thing was, the picture they were taking about of the that would be the retina
mm-hmm.
and when they were taking the pictures, they took quite a few, and I guess only the best two were chosen
mm-hmm.
but I don't know what they did, but they were well cleaned up by the time the doctor showed us the
yeah.
pictures, and you could see all the arteries and the veins, and
mm-hmm. They're really fascinating pictures.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Oh, neat stuff.
So and we got to see yours too,
right?
And it was interesting. The cataract that mm-hmm. you have has so it was really small in the image, but I always thought it would show up as just something like in the lens, right? You'd see kind of something mm-hmm. cloudy. But it showed up like DIC in microscopy, differential interference contrast. It showed up like a 3D structure. Mm-hmm. Is that the way you kind of perceived it?
I didn't. I thought it would be more of a covering. I don't know why.
Yeah. But could you see it okay in the picture?
No, because I have my eyes dilated.
Oh, yeah. You're okay, asking, so you can see it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, it was so small. It's like, and at first I couldn't see it at all. But then when he kept pointing to the same spot from mm-hmm. different angles from his finger, I finally realized what he was talking about. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so it's like this three-dimensional image. It reminds me of the pictures of the cheek cells that are used to show how DIC works in microscopy mm-hmm. versus phase,
right?
Versus phase contrast. Anyway, so that was really fascinating. So
make an appointment with your eye doctor to see these wonderful images. And,
Yep.
And they can tell you an incredible amount about diabetes and other issues.
Yeah, he was saying because they have such good access to blood vessels, to viewing blood vessels.
Right, the resolution.
Yeah, they get, that's where they get the first signs of someone having a problem with diabetes.
Yeah, no, I meant that seriously. Yeah. It's a really good first indicator of any kind of issue like that. Yeah.
And I love the idea of him taking pictures just for the sake of having them on record.
Mm-hmm.
Because so many things like this, you get some measurement from someone and you're worried about a particular disease. What does it mean? There's so many different, there's such a spread in most measurements,
mm-hmm.
biological measurements among individuals in a population. But you get them sequentially,
right?
And you see a change,
right?
Then that's really a good indication that suddenly, especially if you have several that don't change,
right?
And then suddenly you see something.
Yeah, because you also have a certain amount of variation between your patients as well.
They asked me, so do you have any floaties in your eyes? I'm like, oh yeah, I've got plenty. She's like, oh, you do? It's like, yeah, I first noticed them like several years ago and really freaked me out, and but I was busy at the time and I just put off doing something about it, and then, you know, after what, like a year, I'm still alive. So like whatever. Yeah, you just get old, you get floaties in your eyes. Anyway, So I thought that was a neat experience after not having had an eye appointment. There's so much now that I want to go back, but at the time you're hit with this new technology.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
And you don't have time to think about the questions that you want to ask.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm.
So, let's see. What else do I have? So, well, those are the only things that I have that are just from our experiences. I have a bunch of things from stuff we've been looking at in the news that I've thought were really fantastic. But do you have other stuff, like topics of interest that have to do more with being at home and before we go into news type stuff?
Well, right now we're covering energy resources at school.
Uh-huh.
And I guess I was just really impressed that geothermal is being used more in our community than I would have expected. And as I started to have conversations with students and teachers at school, I found out that geothermal in North Carolina is used quite a bit, where even the town hall of Hillsborough has a whole geothermal heating and cooling component for it. So
they use it also for heating.
Yeah.
That's pretty amazing to me.
It is. And so it's something that I have to figure out actually how it works. And I've...
So do you know, can they actually use that directly for heating living spaces and water, or is it more of a preheating, something they're going to heat more with electrical or gas?
From my understanding is that they would pump the air from your home in around these tubes.
Right.
And these tubes would cool or heat depending on
what your goal
is.
Right.
And then it's circulated back through your house.
Okay. So it's for living spaces.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's really cool. Do you know how deep they go?
Okay, so I'm not 100%, but depending on your latitude, they could go, they could be in the upper 6 meters. But
well, that's not very far.
No, it's really not. But there's other ones where there's...
There might not be any reason to... go further than that. I don't know what the temperature profile is, but I suspect close to the surface of the earth, it's pretty drastic. And then as you go down further, there's really not much change.
Right.
So then it just becomes a surface area issue. How much surface area can you get?
Yeah. It's just really interesting. Like, one of my students is going to apply to a private school in mm-hmm. Greensboro. And that's one of the things that the private school, when it takes it, kids on tours or families on tours, they talk about their geothermal heating and cooling unit for the school. So it's just, it's really interesting that it's more widely used than I'd expect. And some of the students were saying that their neighbors have systems set up. So anyway, definitely something to keep in mind as we start to think of different options for heating and cooling.
I just thought of something else for the topics of interest. I've got to write it down before I forget. Quick! Because it's something that you kept talking about. I don't even remember. It's a news item. Anyway, so what else do you have?
That's everything.
Okay.
The other ones I think you're talking about. And
so what about news stuff?
New stuff? I really wanted us to talk about two things in particular, CRISPR and Dicer.
That's right. We said in the title that it was a show about Dicer.
Exactly.
I have to say, both of these articles I thought were really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, although we've talked about Dicer a lot more than about CRISPR. I don't know how much we're going to have to say about that one.
Mm-hmm.
So did you want to start off for...
Actually,
I should do Dicer first because that's older.
Okay. So with Dicer, it's a
bacterial protein originally, isn't it?
Right. And
I don't totally remember.
And it cleaves with RNA? It cleaves double-stranded RNA, I should say.
Yeah, right.
So it's really, it's probably been used a lot in research in that for the last few years for cutting certain parts of DNA, or RNA, I should say. And I think I'll have
Go ahead.
Okay, and I was about to ask you to do more of the specifics.
There's two points. There's one is like the general technology that uses mm-hmm. Dicer, which is RNAi
mm-hmm.
Or RNA interference.
Right.
And then there's the news story, mm-hmm. an article and perspective published in the AAAS Science Journal. Was it 2 weeks ago?
Right.
About, I think. I'm not sure. Anyway, so the way we use Dicer, I mean, I haven't, but I've known people that have, mm-hmm. is basically you insert somehow, either genetically or, I mean, there's various ways to do it, some double-stranded RNA
mm-hmm.
in and this protein, Dicer, usually you have it coded in cells, and the double-stranded RNA is designed so that it matches some RNA for a gene that you want to silence, mm-hmm. that you want to turn off. And Dicer cuts up the double-stranded RNA and makes these really small pieces of single-stranded RNA
mm-hmm.
called, I think they're single-stranded. They're about like 21 nucleotides long, only really short.
Right.
And and combined with a complex of proteins, they seek out matching RNA and cut them up and destroy them.
Right.
And so basically, although the gene could be turned on, all of the RNA that's made from now on that matches the one that you inserted gets cut up. And so there's no protein ever made.
Mm-hmm.
I remember a while ago, it seemed like it was going to be an incredible technology because you just design your RNA and then have it so that it's being produced in the cells. And then suddenly you've shut off a gene. What actually has happened is it's been pretty leaky. In other words, the cells a lot of times still end up making a fair bit of the protein. But it's still used a lot in research, and it works better for some, for silencing some genes than others.
Mm-hmm.
The news story has to do with insecticides. And the idea is you make a genetically engineered plant, and this has been done for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and you have it create and this double-stranded RNA. So
right.
So you genetically alter it so that that's in its genome. And then, and that double-stranded RNA codes for some proteins that are absolutely vital mm-hmm. for your pest, your insect pest. And they eat the plant. And when they eat the plant, they take in this RNA. Then Dicer starts to go, wait, Dicer can't be a bacterial protein. Maybe I'm confusing it with CRISPR. Yeah, I'm confusing it with CRISPR. Dicer is eukaryotic. Anyway, and so the insects take in the double-stranded RNA, and they cut it up and make it into the small RNA, and that silences a gene that's absolutely vital for their
mm-hmm.
Survival, and they die.
Right.
And the problem has been that sometimes it just doesn't seem to work very well.
Right.
And so these researchers, they found out that, well, what did they do? They did several things. They worked on tobacco first
right.
to try to figure out how to get their whole system working, but most of the research ended up in the potato plant.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a beetle, if I remember correctly.
Right.
There was a pest and that would eat the potato plant. And they created different potato plants, and some of them were engineered so that they would attack two proteins in the beetle. One was beta tubulin. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if you don't have tubulin, oh, wait a second. No, it was beta-actin, sorry.
Okay.
But basically, when I think of the cytoskeleton of a cell, I think intermediate filaments, yeah, they're there to do some stuff. And then you have everything that you can think of as structure, like a beam to hold things together. That would be your tubulin and your
right.
microtubule. And anything that you need a cable for to hold things together, that would be actin. Well, suddenly you have no actin.
Right.
So, and then the other protein, I can't remember what it was, but it's had to do with vesicle trafficking, so also an essential protein. And the beetles that ate the potato plant with this double-stranded RNA coded into the plant's nuclear genome,
mm-hmm.
they all did fine. The beetles just survived, and it's like there was no problem.
Right.
But they also encoded in different potato plants so that it was in the genome of the chloroplasts.
Yeah.
The organelle genome.
Mm-hmm.
And when the beetles ate that potato plant, they all died within 5 days, every single one of them.
Right.
It was absolutely, so that was really cool.
That was amazing to
yeah.
me, the fatality rate that they
yeah.
were able to get.
And so the theory is now that the beetles are really good at absorbing double-stranded RNA
mm-hmm.
in their gut, that we know, but not so good at absorbing the small siRNAs that have been already cut by Dicer, right? So the plant, the potato plant's got Dicer. So
right.
it's making the double-stranded RNA, but it's cutting it up also.
Right.
But there's no Dicer in the chloroplast.
Right.
And
right.
so there it stays double-stranded. Then the beetles ingest it. The cells burst in the beetle's gut. And then there's suddenly all this double-stranded RNA. Now, I have to say there is one thing that was a bit funky. A lot of researchers say that have done these types of experiments, they haven't done this really fancy thing looking at nuclear versus organelle genomes. And actually, they've almost all, as far as I know, they've all done it in the nuclear genome. And usually what's found is that you get a certain amount of effect of having the double-stranded RNA, or maybe the siRNA
right
there in the plant, and some of your insects die. While these researchers using the potato plant, none of them died.
Mm-hmm.
So that was, maybe potato handles the double-stranded RNA slightly differently than most of the other plants. Mm-hmm. That was that one question that's raised.
Yeah.
So
that's interesting.
Yeah. But it's really cool to think that you could target individual pests just by, because you decide the
right
sequence on the double-stranded RNA. Right?
Mm-hmm.
You design that. And so you're going to end up being able to target some pests and not others.
Right. And
now, maybe they'll develop resistance to this eventually also, like they do to pesticides.
Mm-hmm.
But you can imagine, you know, it'd be a lot tougher because it's not a molecule that you can mutate a part of your of your protein where the molecule that's a pesticide hooks up to it and
right
then suddenly you're good. You know, this is going right for the sequence of RNA that's supposed to create the protein.
Right.
So transport mechanisms, I suppose, could mutate so that they don't. But then why do they absorb double-stranded RNA so much? I mean, maybe it's important for them. So, oh, you're looking at CRISPR.
Yeah. So now, okay, so we've heard about Dicer.
Dicer.
So what's the big story about CRISPR?
CRISPR.
Yeah.
So is CRISPR, you were looking at it just now, is that bacterial? I think that's what I got.
Yes, it is.
So, okay, so that's purely when it ends up in eukaryotic cells, it's
right
it's because we put it there because
right
of some biotechnological
so,
use that we
right
have. Okay. Now, I know a lot less about the CRISPR story, but the way I understand it is you put the CRISPR gene along with some gene you're interested in,
mm-hmm,
and some flanking sequences, and it looks for those sequences in
right
the target genome and cuts out the gene that used to be there and inserts itself in.
Okay.
And the news story here, some researchers just published, I think it's this very latest Science journal. They didn't publish in the journal. I think it was a news article in Science. And it was a news article because it was controversial.
Right. And it was the implementation
yeah
that was controversial.
Right, right. Yeah. So let me see. So this has to do with things like mosquitoes and malaria and
right
trying to remember.
They were using fruit flies.
They were using Drosophila.
Right.
Oh, right, 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 right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Yeah. Oh, okay. It's a gene drive system. So this is a concept that I learned about from you,
mm-hmm,
this last summer when you were working with Dr. Gould.
Right.
Maybe you want to, I don't know, do you have anything you wanted to go over?
Well,
with that, or before I go on to the CRISPR news?
I'll let you continue because
okay
I think it'll come out as we talk about
okay
the news.
So just really simple, you know, if you want to genetically alter a mosquito so that it can't transmit malaria, or you want to genetically alter it so that it dies.
Right.
In other words, not that the mosquito itself dies right away, but rather it has some gene that's going to cause it to die sooner than normal, and you want that gene
mm-hmm
to, and you want it to breed with other mosquitoes and make the population crash later on.
Right.
How do you get the mosquitoes you release in the wild to get their genes to suddenly show up? That, you know, these genes that you put in there
right
to show up in all the mosquitoes in the wild. And this is a heavily studied area, and it's
mm-hmm
and whatever system you decide to use to try to make this happen is called a gene drive system.
Right.
And they discovered a gene drive system that appears to be incredible.
Right.
That nothing's ever been seen to be such a strong drive. And basically, they take the gene that they're interested in putting into the cells.
Mm-hmm.
They put the gene for CRISPR,
mm-hmm.
and then they put special flanking DNA sequences that match a gene that's already there in the genome of,
right.
in this case, fruit flies, or in the future it'll be worked on mosquitoes. And they create this genetically modified fruit fly in this case. And the gene they incorporated was recessive. So the idea was that if you breed two populations, or you breed a population where
right.
they all have one copy of the recessive gene, you expect one quarter, Mendelian genetics,
right.
one quarter should be both dominant genes, so they look normal.
Mm-hmm.
Another half should also look normal because they've got one recessive, one dominant.
Mm-hmm.
And then a quarter only should look abnormal because they have a double
right.
recessive, right? Or they have two recessive alleles. Well, what happened in this case, and like I said, I don't remember exactly the details. I looked at this a lot less. But basically, they were expected this one quarter ratio, and every single fly had the recessive trait as if it was homozygous recessive. And basically, CRISPR on every single fly, when the two alleles were there, you might have had a dominant and a recessive, and CRISPR went over and ripped out the dominant and placed itself in its place.
Wow.
So, yeah. And so the controversy comes in is because it's so aggressive. And this I really don't understand, but people working on yeast have done this type of thing, and
mm-hmm.
they have safety mechanisms so that they can stop CRISPR from, I guess, causing other genes to be taken out. I'm not exactly
right.
sure. And so they're saying, well, this is really dangerous to do this because who knows what's going to happen. And the people with the fruit fly are like, well, no, it's not a worry. And besides yeast stuff that you do to try to safeguard against CRISPR going out of control is not applicable to Drosophila anyway. And so I just don't know. This
right.
is just this is a news story. So
right.
that's the level of detail I got to.
Yeah. And both of us were kind of giggling because we had worked a little bit with the fruit flies in our genetics class.
I know. That's what's... And they get
all over. Like everyone was mad at our lab at the end of the week because we had contaminated everybody's lab with these Drosophila.
Yeah. So the Institutional Review Board for the people doing the Drosophila work had some really stringent requirements before they allowed them to go through, including creating these multi-layered tubes to keep the flies in, and
mm-hmm.
the whole system behind locked doors and
right.
so on. It's not fair to compare us to
no not there. At all, but yeah. that's
but it's but it does give you the feeling like, really, sure. you're going to be able to stop a fruit fly from getting out? Just give up.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's, I don't know.
Yeah.
Because we were trying to be careful.
We were. And
somehow there's always one little guy that crawls out. And as soon as you have two,
yeah.
they breed.
Yeah. Oh, that's true.
Those were fun experiments.
They were. And you learned a lot from them.
Yeah.
And about controlling the experiment. And it's good. It's a very good experience.
And it's like you were saying about in the title of your blog, Experience is Key.
Mm-hmm.
It's really something to have actually gone through generations with
mm-hmm.
an animal and have created some that are recessive and dominant and
oh,
actually
yeah.
do the counts and do the checks on Mendelian genetics. And
that was amazing.
That was really neat.
Yeah. I think that was really gratifying to see.
And so long ago, I don't even remember. Probably we were looking at red and white eyes or something.
Probably.
Does that sound familiar?
Yeah.
I can't remember.
No, I think you're right. It's just,
it was pretty simple stuff.
It was. Yeah. It was very simple stuff. In fact, every once in a while I think, maybe we could do it in eighth grade.
So, those were the two really cool ones. There's a couple more I wouldn't mind going over, even though we went on pretty long here.
Yeah.
There's the new Raspberry Pi. Mm-hmm. Didn't we mention that in our last one?
No.
The version 2?
We finished the blog and we're like, we can't believe it. We knew there was a Raspberry Pi. We totally didn't mention it.
There's the Raspberry Pi.
That's why I was whispering it to Patrick, because he wanted to say it.
So I can't believe we forgot it and we're about to forget it. So it's the version 2.
Yeah, version 2.
And that's what you got for the three new ones.
No. I have Raspberry.
No, I think they're version 2s.
Are they version 2s?
Yeah.
Twos? Oh. Wow.
They sure look like it.
Really? Because I thought they were a plus, B plus. I was pretty sure they were.
I don't think so.
But you see, they were just ordered because of the mess up.
So it looks like these new ones are quite a bit more powerful.
Yeah.
Now, see, I wanted to mention it last time, and we'd studied all this stuff about what's new about it. Let me see. They have more RAM.
Yeah.
Better
processing speed.
You know, we should probably just hold off on this because I don't remember. I mean, this is from like 3 weeks. It's from before the O-meet.
Right, exactly.
And soon we're going to have experience.
Mm-hmm.
So, but yeah. Yeah, they're using a new CPU,
mm-hmm.
which can truly do... Isn't the 2, for the first time, it can truly do multi... Like, it has several cores on the chip, and it can actually do stuff in parallel for the first time. So, you know, it's not going to speed everything up, but that could substantially speed things up. And
more pins for accessibility.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
It has more pins.
That's what I thought that
should
I read that.
Should be compatible, though.
Yeah, it is, but I thought you had a few extra.
We should do some of our benchmarking since we have some of it. Because I'm looking at the... One of the things we wanted to go over is the guys at Linux Voice, the magazine, awesome magazine. They did some benchmarking of the Raspberry Pi, and I had wanted to go over that. So that was interesting. But we can do the 2. So maybe let's hold off on that.
Okay, we will.
After we've had a bit more experience. I mean, it's not like we're not going to keep talking about Raspberry Pis, right?
Right.
So, you were all about, do you want to go on with more news? Or do you want to do some Raspberry Pi stuff?
No. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you were all about that antibiotic resistance.
Yes, I was. I'd forgotten. I'm sorry. Yeah, it slipped. So I was really interested when you came home and you were telling me about antibiotic resistance not being hospital-based, but more... in the changes that they're noticing in the resistant strains happen to be more agricultural based.
And well, this is in developing countries.
It's
new.
And what kind of fascinated me about that is that I'm really interested in looking at agricultural practices in more of developing countries, because they're kind of in a hard place where they have people.
Agriculture and rural areas kind of go together.
They do.
I'm not so certain it had anything to do with agriculture or rural areas.
Yeah.
I think the point was more simply that in the past, we've thought about antibiotic resistance really... for human pathogens, right?
Mm-hmm.
The worst ones have been come from hospitals, and mostly right. in the West.
Yeah.
Because
we and you used have the image so of TB and things like that. That's
well,
you know,
TB, and but I think by far the biggest is Staphylococcus aureus,
right?
Multi-drug resistant, that you know, shortened to MRSA. There's the way I understand it, at least in some countries, there's been pretty good strides in tackling the problem in Western hospitals.
Right, right.
I think the UK has had some success with reducing MRSA.
And the discussion went to, wow, is this more of an issue because of the unregulated drugs that are used to treat the livestock?
Well, that seemed... Oh, that's right. That's where agriculture come in.
And that's where I got really excited about, because I was...
I think...
Interesting.
The drugs, not the antibiotics, not being regulated, just in a general way, is a huge part of the problem. I mean, it really sounds to me like in most of these countries, you can just go down to some guy down the street and just get any antibiotic you want over the counter from many different places. And people aren't being
monitored.
They're not even being diagnosed.
Right.
Right. They're just like, oh, I'm not feeling good. Let me get a whole bunch of antibiotics and take them.
Right.
And they're many times not indicated, but whatever. Mm-hmm. And of course, use in agriculture is also an issue, like you say.
Right.
But they're two different issues.
Yeah. So,
I mean, I know some people are really worried that because the antibiotic resistance has gotten so bad, and seeing what has happened and how fast some of this resistance has come about, what if we developed a brand new drug now? If we just let things go the way they are, it's going to be useless almost as fast as it's created.
Right.
So there's a big push to change the system for how drug is being delivered for future drugs. You know, it's always hard to, once something's available everywhere, to stop it. And the other thing was that some of these diseases that are resistant in developing countries are really nasty diseases,
right,
compared to, for example, Staph aureus and Pseudomonas here. Let me see, was it typhoid?
Typhoid was the one you mentioned.
And there was another one, I can't remember what. But and of course, I think malaria is probably always on people's mind. But yeah. So I thought that's the one that you'd want to mention.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know if you wanted to go more into it or...
No, but if you wanted to add a bit more to it, that would be wonderful.
I think I said pretty much everything I remembered about
it
off the top of my head. There were two other, insecticidal RNA we went over. Okay, so there's just two others, which I just want to mention because I think they are so cool. Three. Wait, did I just have two? Three. So I wish I had the numbers, but is he still taking astronomy?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's something that came up with him. But I guess in the last couple of weeks was published the finding that we found the fastest, what's called hypervelocity star in the entire galaxy.
Oh, yeah. He was fascinated by this.
A hypervelocity star, an HVS. Mm-hmm. It's a star. So everybody understands the concept of escape velocity on Earth, if you go a certain speed, then you're not in orbit anymore. You're just going to leave, and you're never going to come back without any other forces applied to you. So the concept of escape velocity would apply to stars over the area, the volume, I guess we should say, of the entire galaxy, is that if a star is going fast enough relative to the galaxy, it's reached escape velocity for the galaxy. And these are known as hypervelocity stars, or HVSs. And this one was particularly interesting because it's a different mechanism. I think most of them are created, people think, by being part of a pair that gets close to a black hole and then gets flung out. And this one had a different mechanism. I don't remember exactly what it was, but it's not a concept I'd ever come across before. Hypervelocity stars, and I'll have to look up exactly what the speeds are, I can't remember, but that would be interesting. Let's see. The other thing that I thought was really cool is it has to do with muons. Did we talk about the muons last time?
I remember talking a bit about them.
Oh, maybe we went over this already. So I guess I'll leave it. Anyway, we can always check, and if we didn't, then I'll bring it up the next time. Because if we didn't, just as a real quick thing, it's like muons created in the upper atmosphere. You know, they're always raining down on us. And someone has figured out that, you know, as they hit matter, they send off a signal. And where the matter's denser, you get more of this signal. And it can be seen by creating these tanks of, I don't know what kind of liquid they put inside, but it scintillates from, so you get flashes of light from this signal. And I don't remember the particle that's part of the signal. And they're putting these all around Fukushima, where the nuclear reactor went critical. And they still don't know exactly where all of the radioactive material is. And so they're using this as a kind of an X-ray, and using, instead of having your own probe that you send in, you know, by particles like X-rays, they're using the natural muons raining down on us. I just thought that was amazing. I think we did talk about it last time.
I think we did just a bit.
But it's just so incredibly cool.
It amazes me.
Anyway, that's all I had, actually. Okay. I had one other, but I think I'll keep it. There's a new type of 3D printing. It's not really 3D printing. It uses oxygen with a liquid interface, and it sounds really interesting, but I think I'll talk about it next time.
Okay.
So be on the lookout for that.
Okay.
In the future. Yep. Did you have something else?
No.
Okay. So what about future plans?
Future plans. I will be digging into the Raspberry Pi a little bit more and looking at the updated version, seeing if I might need one ordered for myself. And
mini 3-day vacation.
And a mini 3-day vacation to go hiking at Limbo Gorge, which is always...
As a recompense for having done a good job and working so hard at the OMI.
Yeah, so we're both very excited about that. That'll be neat. So a lot to look forward to, but no stress.
No, for the first time in...
So that's good.
A long time,
So, very exciting. Well.
So I guess we should wrap it up.
Yeah.
Okay, so... you have the paper. Okay. So thank you for listening to the Frontal Harvest podcast.
Make sure to check out the blog.
Goodbye.